Pure Dog Talk is the voice of purebred dogs. We talk to the legends of the sport and give you the tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. Welcome to Pure Dog Talk. I'm your host, Laura Reeves, and I have a really fun guest for us today. This is Debbie Cutter, who has been working with Scottish Deerhounds at the highest levels of obedience for, is it 30 years now, Debbie?
About 33 years with the Deerhounds, 32, 33.
That's so amazing. We talk about our sighthounds not really excelling in the obedience arena. And so I am super excited to talk to you about obedience with Deerhounds, because I just think it's fabulous.
It's been fun. It's been an exciting several decades.
So what made you, I think you mentioned that your first dog was a German Shepherd that you earned a UD with, but then your second dog is a Deerhound. So I want to know how that transition happened.
Well, this is kind of funny because my best friend was up visiting over this past weekend. We were doing some training together. She has a Deerhound that she's working in utility also. And she had asked me this question, and I was going over my early memories of how I first came upon the Scottish Deerhound as a breed that I was interested in. And she basically told me that my early memories were all wrong, and that was not how it was. So anyway, but I had just read a study recently that said that people over 60 years old have like a 40% false memory rate. And being in that demographic, unfortunately, now, I may totally have been misremembering the whole thing. But anyway, as I remember it, this is what happened. The German Shepherd was my novice A dog. He was my first dog and my first obedience dog. My mother had had a Shepherd when my brother and I were young, and she put a CD on him. And he ended up with severe hip dysplasia, and she returned him to his breeder. So when I was thinking about getting a dog, which was occasioned by my boyfriend at the time, wanted to get a lab. And we had had cats, and I really didn't want a dog. We were graduate students, and I was really focused on earning my degree and going into a research career and all of that. And we traveled on the weekends. I'm like, we don't have time for a dog. We really don't need a dog. And so the only time that he ever showed any real shrewdness and intelligence was when he decided that the only way he was going to get a dog was if I got a dog first. So he said, okay, what kind of dog would you get? And I said, well, I would get a German Shepherd. That's what my mother had. And I would probably want to do some obedience training because she seemed to really enjoy that. And the dog was very smart and really seemed to like working. So I ended up getting a German Shepherd. He shortly thereafter got his Labrador. And I started training my Shepherd in obedience. And fortunately, at the time, pretty much the only obedience training around was put on by local obedience training clubs. And I was living in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Oh, yeah.
So I got in with classes at the Greater Raleigh Dog Training Club. And everyone there was a competition trainer. And so it was understood that when you went into the beginner class, you were training for a CD title, you know, a novice
right.
title in AKC obedience.
And this is long before Raleigh. We didn't have Raleigh then.
That's right. In fact, this was back in the early 80s.
Right.
So I started training my Shepherd, and she was coming along nicely, and then she started getting a little lame. She was 10 months old and diagnosed with severe hip dysplasia. So I was heartbroken. I was like, okay, well, we're not going to have any kind of a future in obedience. And I was really hooked on obedience training. It was just, I just loved it. It was just so exciting and so challenging, and I knew it was something I was going to want to keep on doing. So she got her CD shortly thereafter, and I thought, okay, well, that's going to be the end of her career, because this was back before the jump heights came down, and any dog over 24 inches or over was jumping 36-inch high jump and a 72-inch broad jump, and physically, I didn't think that was something that she was going to be able to do. So being really naive, just a naive little grad student, and way before the days of internet, I was thinking, okay, well, shepherds are bred an awful lot, so maybe if I looked at less popular breeds, they would be healthier. Which, you know, totally that was wrong, but, you know, back at the time, you know, you just had library books to go to, and that was pretty much it.
Right.
And dog shows. So my memory was I had gotten the old AKC Red book that had all the different breeds in it.
Yep.
Any other book that I could get out of the library. And somewhere in that book, I was going through looking at the pictures, and there was a picture of a Scottish Deerhound doing a broad jump. So the subconscious thought got planted. Okay, if the AKC has a picture of a Scottish Deerhound doing a broad jump, they must be really good at doing obedience. Not knowing that at the time, this was probably the only Scottish Deerhound who had ever done a broad jump in the history of the breed, ever, up to this time. And I was telling my friend this, and she said, I remember that picture, but it wasn't a deer hound. It was a Commodore.
What?
Well, then why did I not end up with a Commodore? Why did I end up with a Scottish deer hound? But she remembered that being a Commodore doing the broad jump. So,
oh my
gosh. In any case, whether or not it was a deer hound or a Commodore, somehow that got me thinking about deer hounds.
Oh my God. And so where did you go to find a deer hound? What was your early mentor? Where do you go to find a deer hound that'll do obedience?
Well, this is, you know, in the pre-internet days.
Right,
you know,
right.
When you don't go on Facebook and ask that question.
Right, exactly.
People do these days. Yeah. So I was living in Raleigh, and we trained our obedience trials in the area. We're at the local fairgrounds and part of some big all-breed clusters. So I was out at dog shows pretty often. So after I had looked at this book and read about deer hounds and some other books, and there was not a lot of information on deer hounds at all, I went and watched the deer hound ring, and there were three or four deer hounds entered and a couple of breeders. And I was just watching, just thinking, you know, these are amazing dogs. I love the look, you know, that kind of rugged beauty.
Right.
And they're big, but they're so graceful, and they're so light on their feet. And they just had this otherworldly, you know, just something about them just really caught me. You know, kind of like the Wirehair Pointer.
It's, right.
They're rugged, they're handsome, but they're athletic.
Right.
There's just a beauty that's not frou-frou. It's
no. The deerhound float. I just love that deerhound float. I've always just admired the breed for how they just are so incredibly graceful.
Well, they're a big dog, but they're really light. They're all legs and hair.
Yes.
There's not a lot of mass to them. And so anyway, I was sitting outside the deer hunting ring watching, and one of the breeders asked me to hold one of her dogs because they, you know, you always show up too many dogs and not enough people.
Right.
And she handed me this leash, and I just looked down at this dog. It was a big male, as I recall. And again, this is a long time ago. I don't remember who the dog was. And he just had this expression. His expression was just wise and friendly and kind. Just like, this human has my leash and I'm perfectly okay with it. He didn't try to get away. He didn't like jump up and wag or sniff or anything like a lot. He just stood there very calmly, very gentlemanly, and just kind of looked at me like, everything's okay. And I thought, this dog is just so darn cool. So I talked to one of the breeders and said I was really interested in a deer hound, and I was a graduate student, and I lived in a little bitty house, and I didn't have any money. And asked her, you know, the first question that turns every breeder off that I know now is, well, how much do they cost? And she told me, and I'm like, okay, there's no way in the world I can afford that. And I said, thank you very much, and went home and continued doing research, mostly on deer hounds. So eventually I wrote her a letter, got her address out of the catalog, wrote a letter on it, and said I was really interested in a Scottish deerhound and if she could maybe put me on one of her puppy lists. So she did, and about 9 months later, she gave me a call and said that she had a puppy available, and that was Scarlett. That was my first deerhound. So I went up to pick up the puppy, and I was just talking to the breeder about, she was telling me about, you know, feeding and exercise and things like that. And I just happened to mention, do you know how many obedience titled deer hounds there have been? And I figured there would probably be a whole bunch, and she could just name off a bunch. And she looked at me horrified. She said, do not try to do obedience with deer hounds. They don't like it, and they're not any good at it. And that was that.
Mm-hmm.
Right there, then I said, well, I'm going to do obedience with this deer hound, and we're going to do damn well.
Oh, my gosh. So what you're telling me is that your success is because you are more stubborn than your dogs.
Yes, and that's kind of the basic essential thing for training deer hounds is being more stubborn than the dog.
Oh my gosh.
Or the dog's breeder sometimes.
Yes, well, there you go. I show a lot of sight hounds. I own a few sight hounds. That is everybody's response to sight hounds and obedience. Oh, please, God, no. What is your secret to success? How have you been successful in taking a breed that is notoriously very much their own independent little breed mind, and they don't necessarily want to do what you think is a good idea? How have you had that success? I think it is so fascinating.
Well, probably a little bit of luck, but because when you get a deer hound, the first thing that they are going to try to teach you, and I tell this to people all the time because I will hear things on the email list like, I took my deer hound puppy to obedience class, and the first thing he did was lay on his back and refuse to move and then scream. And I was so embarrassed, I just took him out to the car and we went home and we never went back to class. So the first thing they try to teach you is that they can't do obedience, and anytime you try to impose your will on a deer hound, they're going to go, no, you're not going to make me do this. and I'm going to embarrass you until you just quit, because they don't want people to have expectations. Because once the owner starts having expectations that they're going to be required to meet, then the deer hound can no longer just lay around and sleep all the time, which is what they want to do when they're in the house. And their life of luxury is pretty much over.
Mm-hmm.
So I've kind of found out that if you get a puppy, and this is kind of one of my favorite word on this, if you can get the puppy to buy into obedience as a fun activity, then you've got them. And the way I think that this worked for me to do this is you let the puppy be in control. You teach the puppy that he controls the treats, that he controls the activity, he or she. And mostly I've trained bitches, and the boys are just kind of mentally not as tough. You teach the puppy that she's in control. They love to manipulate people. It's just one of their really good talents. And the first thing they try is to manipulate people into not ever trying to train them. And when that doesn't work, but you can get them to go, okay, if I make eye contact with my mom, she says yes, and she gives me a treat. And that's right. The first thing my puppies learn is that if they make eye contact, they control the dispensing of the treats.
Nice.
And anytime they make eye contact, I go, yes, and they get a treat. And so, like, I can make mom say this word, and I get a treat every time I make eye contact. And then you just kind of expand on that. And then the puppy's like, I've got this nailed. I'm in control of this whole thing. And then they start seeing what else they can make you do.
Nice. See, now, we haven't mentioned this, but we were talking off air earlier. I know that you own a wire hair pointer, that you're working in obedience as well. And I always tell people that the breed will literally do backflips if they think it's their idea.
Yes. Yeah. Same kind of thing with the deer hounds. You want them to think it's all under their control and it's their idea.
Love it.
So that's the little bit of the challenge. But once you get them to buy into the idea that learning tricks is fun and learning new skills is fun, most of them get really excited about it. They're extremely bright dogs, and that's one thing people don't understand or don't believe or don't think they can use to their advantage, is these guys are really, really smart. They learn extremely quickly. They're very focused. They're not very distractible. They remember things for a long time. They generalize exceedingly well. And so you wonder, why isn't everyone out training deer hounds in obedience? It's because the downside is they are not at all biddable, like any of the sight hounds. They're just not biddable dogs.
Right.
It's like, I know, I understand what you want. I know what you want me to do, so.
I just don't care.
I don't care. It's like, what's in it for me?
Right.
And so everything is a risk-benefit analysis. Anything you ask a deer hound to do, they run that calculation.
Fascinating. All right, so make them think it's their idea, and you have, what is it now, 6 UD or UDX deer hounds, is that right?
8.
8?
8 UD deer hounds, 2 of which have gone on to UDXs, and then my girl has 8 UDX legs so far.
So you're going to actually get to make an Otch deer hound.
God, I'm hoping. That's my goal with her.
Has there ever been an Otch deerhound?
No.
Goodness. So this is history in the making right here.
Yes. Well, I had the first UDX deerhound, actually the first 2 UDX deerhounds, the only 2 UDX deerhounds so far, and the first deerhounds that got any of the AKC VCD titles. And I'm really hopeful with this girl. The problem with the deerhounds, of course, is their working life is not very long.
Right. Right.
You've got 8 to 9 years kind of maximum, and then 9 years you're down to 1 show a weekend instead of 2. And at least with my girls who've got their UDXs at more advanced ages.
Mm-hmm.
But so far she's got 6 Otch points and her open B first placement. So
nice.
So I'm just hoping. And
that is
UDX
amazing.
Her OM1. So.
Okay. So back to how you've accomplished this pretty amazing success. So you make them think it's their idea. And what's the next step?
Well, the next step is you break everything down into very small pieces. You know, each exercise is things like, okay, you're working on attention, and I start attention, you know, with the dog just standing in front of me looking up at me.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's moving attention where I'll move my head fractionally to the left, and I'll have a treat in my mouth or something, and they've already learned to kind of look where the food is. And if they shift their feet to their right a little bit, I'll mark it and pay it, clip and treat.
Mm-hmm.
And that teaches them to move with my face because I train for eye contact when we're healing.
Okay.
And so it's like one little step to the left, another little step to the left, a few more steps to the left, and then back to the right. And so the dog is going like 270 degrees around me, just with me moving my head, and they're moving in front of me with eye contact. And they think it's a really fun game. They're like, oh, look what I trained my mom to do.
She's like a Pez machine. Look at this. She's spitting food at me.
Exactly. Yeah, all I have to do is move, and it makes her like move her head and follow me, and then I get treats.
Right. It's all predicated on that I made mom do this rather than mom made me do this.
Right. At the beginning, because this is getting the buy-in. And
okay.
Once they're committed to being able to train their mom with a high degree of proficiency, then you can start asking them for a little more. And at some point, the equation shifts a little bit to, okay, now I can get you to do this, but I'm going to pay you for it.
Right.
And it's all a negotiation with the deer hounds. And I think people who just say, okay, I want a dog who's going to do what I tell them, are not going to be successful, because it's really all negotiation. It's, okay, would you do this for this treat? Okay, maybe not for that, but for this treat. Would you do this if I take the leash and place you in this position mm-hmm. and then give you this treat?
Mm-hmm.
And so just kind of build on this. But after the dog has a certain amount of time committed in training you, then they're a lot more tolerant to you having them do some more complex tasks.
Right.
Because they're committed to the training relationship, like they're committed to this game that you have together.
And so then that's where you start building it as a teamwork.
Right.
Hang tight, guys. Got a little bit of information for you. We'll be right back to the podcast in a minute.
How much is that doggy in the window?
Okay, crew. I hear it pretty much every day now. I love Pure Dog Talk. And that makes my heart happy, because I love doing it. I started hosting Pure Dog Talk as a way to reach out to members of our community with education and resources to enable you to succeed and move forward in your goals and ambitions. And your response has been literally overwhelming. The podcast has been downloaded well over 250,000 times to date. That's incredible. All of this information is free to exhibitors around the world at the touch of a button. But here's the reality check. Money really does make the world go round, guys. So, I created a special patrons group. This funding source helps cover the expenses of audio editing and website hosting and technology and like that. Patrons keep Pure Dog Talk's fountain of knowledge flowing freely. And like the NPR of dogdom, our patrons support Pure Dog Talk with monthly gifts. We even offer advertising and sponsorship opportunities that you guys may not have known about. So, drop me a note, laura@puredogtalk.com, and I'll let you know how you can help share the love. They start out being in charge, and then it becomes both of you working equally. Is that what you're trying to say?
Yeah, pretty much. You need to get them committed to the game, that obedience mm-hmm. is fun, that learning new things is fun, that working with mom is fun. Even if they'd rather be taking a nap, that's, oh, let's go practice some healing. Oh, that's so much fun. Let's do some jumps. Oh, that's so much fun.
Right.
And I don't do all positive stuff. I feel like I'm a balance trainer.
Mm-hmm.
But once they learn the rules,
right.
Deer hounds are very rules-oriented. I guess like the wire hairs, too.
Yeah.
You know, once they learn the rules, you by gosh better stick to the rules. If you mess with the rules, they are not going to be happy with you.
Right. So that strong leadership, right, that goes with the rules-based and that leadership position, then they have that respect that comes with that. Is that what you're aiming for?
No.
No.
No, you don't really ever have a leadership position. It's always sort of a negotiation. Sometimes the deerhound is in the leadership position, but that's okay.
Interesting. Okay, yeah. So that is very different than a lot of the work that I've done in what little bit of obedience I've done with my dogs. And I think a fascinating concept, and one that I think a lot of people would struggle with.
Yes, yes. And some of my training partners who don't have deer hounds are wondering, well, why don't you just correct that? It's like, no, that doesn't work that way. There's some things that I've not found. Like I do a force retrieve. I do an ear pinch retrieve.
Right.
Because a deerhound has no interest in retrieving. They have no genetic desire to retrieve. It's not a behavior that exists really in the breed.
And that's exactly, this is my next question, was actually retrieving, because the sighthounds I've had are like, are you kidding me?
Yeah. It can be a battle. It can really be a battle. And I try to be extremely fair with it. Mm-hmm. I teach him the behavior I want, you know, place the dumbbell in their mouth mm-hmm. over and over, have them reach for the dumbbell, try to be very patient. But at some point, the deer hound's going to put up their middle finger and go, no, I'm not playing this today. I've got something else to do. Mm-hmm. And at that point, you know, I'm going to say, okay, well, if you're not picking up the dumbbell, then I'm putting my finger on your ear. And then right. we kind of go back and teach that whole thing.
Right.
And generally, they're smart enough, and they're also very comfort motivated. So, you know, there's no random acts of violence. It's just kind right. of a discomfort thing. Right. And they're like, well, okay, fine. If it means that much to you, I guess I'll do it. But it's not a fun thing. It's not something you just casually do. Like, I think I'll just teach a sight hound to retrieve today.
No.
At least with the deer hounds. It can take kind of a long time, and you have to kind of be really sort of careful about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because you still want them wanting to play the game, and you have to make the rules super clear. And once the rules are there and you feel like you both understand the same set of rules, you have to really enforce.
Right.
But be very fair, because since they are rules-oriented dogs, if the rule is, you know, you pick up the dumbbell under this circumstance, it's got to be you pick up the dumbbell under this circumstance and this one and this one and this one and this one.
Right.
And if they choose not to, you've got to show them. So they're like, okay, well, I didn't understand I needed to do it, but now I do. And so now I understand I have to pick up the dumbbell under this circumstance too.
Interesting. So expanding that, if you will, comfort zone bit by bit.
Yeah.
Just that incremental advancement of their understanding.
Right. And sometimes it can be more than incremental. They do super well at proofing. If you set up, you know, a proofing exercise kind of the right way, in such a way that they have the foundation to solve the problem if they focus on it, and it's something that makes them come back stronger with a better understanding of the exercise, they really enjoy that. Well, I've had some that are mentally a little lazier, and it's like, mm-hmm. I don't really want to proof. Can't you just pattern train me and just show me what you want? Don't make me think so hard. But most of them, and the girl I'm training now, she thinks proofing is a blast. And it's like she kind of gets to where you can't set up a scenario that will confuse me or fool me or make me not do this.
Oh, interesting.
And that is so much fun. That is so much fun to have a dog like that. That's like, okay, bring it on. No matter what you do to me, I'm going to, you know, and not in a bad way.
Right,
but things
right.
like her dumbbell retrieve was a little bit sloppy at a trial. She sniffed the mat before she picked up the dumbbell. So I tossed her dumbbell in a little pile of treats the next time we had a training session. And she ran out there and she goes, oh, this is a setup. And she grabbed that dumbbell and she just came flying back. Like with an expression on her face, like, oh, you so did not fool me.
Oh, that's fabulous.
But it's just so cute. And she gets really pumped up. And then she's like, yeah, you know, her tail's wag. And she's like, ah, I saw through that. That was so lame.
I tell people all the time that wire hairs are smarter than their owners. That sounds like deer hounds are right up there.
Yes, they are. They absolutely are like that, yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, I'd say a smart deer hound and a smart white hair are pretty similar in the smarts department.
Interesting. Okay, now the other thing I wanted to mention briefly, you were just at, and I'm not going to get the name of it right, the National Obedience Championship?
Yes.
Not too long ago. And have you been to that event previously? And how crazy is it to see a Scottish deer hound at the National Obedience Championship with the Goldens and the Shelties in the labs?
Well, that whole thing, no, that was the first time I had been to one. And there were a few reasons why I went. I'm not a tournament kind of person. I'm not a competitive type person. If I was, I wouldn't have a deer hound. I'd have a Golden or a Border Collie or something
right.
like that. My goal was always to do our personal best, mm-hmm. to improve on what we can do as a team. And it was nearby. They had changed the venue, so it was over in Ohio, which was about 3 hours away from me. So first of all, it was kind of close. And then people kept telling me, you need to go, you need to go. And I was going to go and volunteer and steward because I'd never even seen one before, although I've heard they were pretty crazy and pretty hectic and massively huge and extremely busy. And I thought it would be really fascinating to steward and just watch these excellent teams up close. So I was going to just volunteer and go to steward. And people said, no, you've got to go. You've got to go. And the two people who mostly twisted my arm was Kay Braddock, and you know.
Yes.
She said, you've got to go because the judges really like seeing unusual breeds. She said, when I have Belle there, they think it's so cool to see a white hair pointer. You know, and it was kind of emailing back and forth. And I said, do you really think they'd be interested in seeing a deer hound? Or would they just go, oh, Jesus, who's brought a deer hound to the end? But she said, no, honestly, the judges really think it's fun to see a different breed. And I asked a few other people who I also, you know, are experienced handlers, who I respect their opinion. I respect
right.
their expertise. And I know Kay had been with Belle to several of these. And I have a friend over in Dayton, Anita Easton, who was my training partner when I lived over there for a couple of years. And she said she'd be my coach. She said, you have to go and I'll be your coach. So she was going over there to show in the Rally Nationals, which was the day before.
Mm-hmm.
And when she said that, it was like, well, I guess I have to go because, I mean, that's such a generous offer.
Right.
And they're just making it so I really can't say no. So, and I thought, okay, it's not about competing. It's really about celebrating obedience and celebrating obedience with a dog who's earned her right to be there.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, she did qualify, even though it was only just a few watch points, but still. And so I thought, okay, I'll just go and I'll just see what we can do. But my main concern about it was not that she was a deer hound or that people would say, what's a deer hound doing there? It's that in the obedience world, she's a very green dog. And she has 70 ADX legs. She was turning 4 years old on the day of the event. It had been less than 6 months since she'd gotten her UD, and I just felt she was too green a dog to face that kind of an event, that it would just be too much for her with her level of experience and training. And I was really worried that it would really hurt her confidence and maybe make her think obedience was not really that much fun. And my fear with her is that once I lose that buy-in, I'm going to lose her as
right.
a partner,
right.
that she's not going to play the game. And once you lose that, I don't think these guys are going to get it back. Probably like a wire hair. You know,
yeah.
once that faith is broken,
yeah.
it's broken. And it's a horrible thing and you've lost it and it was your own fault.
Right.
But that's my big fear with her, is messing her up. So I was like, you know, I'm listening to people. They're kind of pushing me to do something my gut says may not be such a good idea.
Mm.
But, you know, I was the one sending in the entry fee, so I couldn't blame anybody else. So we went over there and it pretty much went how I was afraid it was going to go for a little while. We went in there and she was looking around like, oh my God. It was like a little kid from the mountains, from a little mountain town going to the Mall of America for the first time. And if a dog could stand there with her jaw dropped, you know, that would be what she was doing. But her little eyes were huge. She walked in there. She's like, holy crap. I don't know what this is. I don't know where we are. I don't know what we're doing. And I thought, oh, okay, this is not going to be so good.
Mm-hmm.
We went in the little warm-up ring, and I threw the dumbbell, and she went out to it, and she stopped dead, and she looked around like, what the hell is this? It was on this, like, blue matting. And so I thought, okay, this is not going well. But I said, okay, I said, well, sorry, if things go, like, down the toilet, we'll just leave. I just said, excuse us, and we will just leave, and that will do that. So we started in the first ring, and first thing was there was a retrieve and a go-out in directed jumping. And I threw the dumbbell, and it kind of took a weird bounce, and she went out to it, and she stopped, and she looked over into the other ring and just stood there for what seemed like an hour, but it was probably like 5 seconds. And then she picks up the dumbbell really slowly and trots back and gives a crappy front and a crappy finish. I'm like, okay, this is bad. This is bad. And our second thing was a go-out, and she really amazed me because she found her go-out, even with all the banners and stuff, and there was a ring to the side and a ring behind her, people all around. So I send her on a go out, and she goes, and instead of sitting and looking back at me, she sits up against the gate with her head over the ring, looking at the dog in the other ring that was doing a retrieve. Just fascinated. And I'm like, oh my God. So I give her a real loud command to jump and give her, and she turns around and goes, oh, okay. Comes over the jump, jumps in. Okay, send her out for the second jump, which she's going to jump toward the ring on the other side.
Mm.
She goes out, hits her go out beautifully, does her sit, takes her jump, and lands near the ring gate, near one of the banners, and stops dead, watching the judge put out scent articles in the other ring. And she just stood and watched the judge and watched the judge. This is going on, and the judge in my ring was kind of over in the corner, and then she kind of like shakes her head and looks up and goes, oh my God, where am I? And she sees the judge and starts toward him, and she goes, oh my God, that's not my mom. And then she turns around and looks back at the jump, and she's going to start to go back over the jump, and then I called her into front. Okay,
right.
That's what we got to keep there.
Right.
But it was like, oh my God. And so the next two rings were also pretty bad. And I figured out what it was later, is we would go in a ring and there would be just whatever jump or whatever prop was needed for that particular exercise. So we went in the ring and there was a high jump on the right side of the ring because we were doing, I guess, drop on recall and retrieve over the high jump.
Mm.
And I figured out later what she was doing is she would go in the ring and try to figure out based on the ring what we were doing. And she'd go in and like, this doesn't look like an open ring. The jumps are wrong. This doesn't look like, well, the utility ring, the directed jumping, it was set up looking like a utility ring. So she
mm-hmm.
was like, okay, we're doing a go out. But otherwise she was trying to read the context from how the ring was set up, being a rules kind of dog.
Right.
And she couldn't do it because it didn't make any sense to her.
Fascinating.
So it was really bad. The first three rings, and I don't know if you want to even hear about this much details, I'm kind of like reliving this whole nightmare. You know, I'd set her up and she was like panting. Her ears were pinned back. She wasn't quite shaking yet, but she was kind of on the verge of starting to shake, which she does when she's really, really, really stressed. I'm like, oh my God, what am I doing to this dog? So we left the third ring after she had NQ'd something. And I told Anita, I said, I'm pulling her. Mm. She's crashing and burning. She doesn't know what she's doing. I'm going to pull her. And she said, don't do it. Just stick with it. And for some stupid reason, normally I don't listen to other people when they tell me what to do with my dog, but I did. So we went ahead in the other ring, and that was the one they were streaming live. Mm-hmm. And it was signal exercise, broad jump, and a drop on recall. And when we went in there and set up for the signal exercise, she kind of looked at me, and her little eyes kind of cleared, and she says, we're doing obedience, aren't we? I think we're doing obedience. And so I started doing the signal exercise, and she did a pretty credible signal exercise. She qualified. She did her signals really nicely. Then we did a broad jump, which she did pretty nicely. And then we did a drop on recall, which she did really nicely. And when we came out of the ring, she gave me a little hand touch. She jumped up and gave me a little bump on my hand, which she doesn't do when she's really stressed. I'm like, she's figured out we're doing obedience. And she had this relieved expression like, I get it now. I get what we're doing. And she qualified the rest of the rings, doing a pretty nice job. So if I had not stuck with it, I would not have known what kind of resilience she had. And I was literally in awe of the trust and resilience she gave me that day. I just couldn't believe it.
I love that.
Such a green dog.
I love the hand bump. That's so cute.
But that showed me she was in the game with me. She was like, okay, Mom, I got it. And I'm in the game. My head's back in the game with you.
Nice.
And it was just really special. And it was just so amazing to me that she could pull up that much strength when she was just so overwhelmed. And she said, okay, not only can I do this, but I can do it well. And I know what I'm doing and I know my job and we're going to do it.
Awesome.
And every time I got her out of her crate for the next ring, she just came out. Like she came out like, okay, we're going to work. Okay, we're going to do it. And she was exhausted by the end of the day, and so was I, and we didn't make it to the second round.
It sounds like a really, very, very stressful.
It was. But the issues we had were not from her being a deer hound. Mm-hmm. It was her being a really green dog and me not knowing how to train for an event like that because I hadn't done one before.
Right. Well, now you have. There's a whole nother one next year.
Exactly. I know. I've already got my motel reservation.
Look at you. Way to go. Awesome.
Of course, I may not go, but at least I have my reservation.
Oh, my God. All right. Well, I thank you so much for your time and sharing your amazing journey. I just think this is pretty outstanding, the work that you're doing and the information that you're able to share with our listeners about that bond and that connection. I think that's very special. I appreciate your time.
It is extremely special. And without, purebred breeders producing purebred deer hounds, this wouldn't be an adventure I could have.
Absolutely.
I mean, they're just amazing, amazing dogs. I'd just like to say anyone who's considering getting a deer hound, but for some reason just hasn't done it. I mean, they're just awesome dogs. They're great to live with. They're great to train. They're a lot of fun. They have a good sense of humor. And you'll just wonder how you got by without one.
I love that. I love that. No, that's perfect. All right. Well, thank you so much, Debbie, and I wish you the very best going forward.
Well, thank you, Laura. I really appreciate it.
The Dog Show Superintendents Association is a proud supporter of Pure Dog Talk. Our dog show superintendents are the hardworking people who make the dog show function. They are advocates for education and mentorship in the purebred dog fancy. So stop by the super's desk at your next show. Tell them how much you love Pure Dog Talk and give them a shout out for their support. That's all for today. Thank you for joining us on Pure Dog Talk.